Time to take a look at the wonderful world of wildlife. Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Glad to have you listening in. Give us a call with your question at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org, and we'll get you on the air and get your question in. Scott, welcome back.
Good morning, Larry. It's great to be here.
Good to have you here. The hunting seasons are pretty well over, but we aren't very far from spring turkey season. Permits have been sent out, and extra permits go on sale on March 23rd.
Yes, there are a lot of extra permits available, as there have been for the past couple of years. Things are a bit different this year because of the amalgamation of the zones from many small ones into a few large ones. So the unit, for example, that encompasses most of southwestern Wisconsin, west of Madison here, I think there are 20, 30,000 permits left. But most of these permits that are still available are concentrated in the final three periods of the turkey hunting season. Mm-hmm. Most of the hunters try and get in early. Those permits went on the normal application process. But if you'd like an extra permit or didn't get one at all and want a chance to go late, and I've had some pretty good hunts in the fourth and fifth periods, even the sixth, then the sale starts. Go to the DNR website, check the sale schedule. It's by unit beginning on the 23rd. And there are many different ways to purchase a permit. The DNR assures everyone that all of the problems that we've seen the past couple of years with gridlock and all have been resolved. The vendor paid a bit of a penalty, I guess, and everybody's assuring us that this will go smoothly. But there are lots of additional permits out there for folks who want them. And even the regular hunting and fishing licenses, which expire at the end of this month, go on sale today, I believe it is. So if you want to cure a little of that cabin fever or seasonal affective disorder, go buy yourself a new fishing or hunting license and think about everything that's going to happen over the next few months.
Sounds like a plan. Let's take a call. Stacy in Wausau has been waiting here, so let's go there. Hi, Stacy.
Hi. My question is, how do we feed the birds this spring and summer without attracting bears? I live in a neighborhood where there's been multiple bear sightings last summer.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure one bear helped himself to our bird feeder, and I just wanted your advice on it.
Yeah.
Well, that's a very difficult question to answer, Stacy. There are lots of bears around, as you, if you've been listening over some past shows, we've talked about the tremendous increase in the bear population statistically in terms of some new estimates of the population that have been released over the past few months. And harvest permits have been increased to reflect that. The bottom line is there are a lot of bears. And if you already know there are some in your area, then a feeder that's affixed to a deck or readily accessible to the bears is likely to be found. And it doesn't take a bear very long to reduce a feeder to no seeds and not much of a feeder. So the things to do are, you know, keep your eyes open, talk to your neighbors. If a bear's in the area and, you know, somebody warns you about that, I'd simply take the feeders down and not even put them out until the coast is clear, so to speak. You may not know that all the time, though, so to the extent that you can get the feeders up off the ground on a pulley or cable system, for example, so that they're not readily available to the bears, but you can reel them in, essentially, to feed them, that's about the only thing you can do. But there have been, for the last quite a while, there's been a series of photographs circulating on the internet that show a pretty sizable bear kind of handlining itself down a cable to get at a feeder that's hanging out over open space. I mean, the bear's kind of dangling there in free space, but they will go to great lengths, as will squirrels. You know, think of a bear as just a gigantic squirrel when it comes to defeating your feeders. So you have to be pretty creative, and the more flimsy you can support it. In other words, you put up a big heavy cable, the bear may be able to shinny out on that.
Mm-hmm.
But put up something that's discreet so that they just don't break it down and get the feeder that way. And it may take a few options to try and beat the system. And it may get to the point that for periods of time in the summer, you just back off on the feeding.
Yeah.
Winter's the primary bird feeding period. Nice to be able to feed in the summer and still see some of the young birds coming in. But in a high bear density area, you may just not be able to do it.
I wonder if a person could use a wire, sort of a flexible wire for the instead of a heavy cable, something a little quite a bit lighter.
I think so, and you know, that's the kind of thing, something that the bear wouldn't even detect or see,
right,
that's suspending
right.
the feeder is probably the winning strategy, but it's going to take a little creativity and persistence, Stacy. But
good luck.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Stacy. Brad in Oshkosh, on to you now. Hi, Brad.
Hey, guys. I got a couple questions. You guys brought up turkey hunting in the beginning. I've heard a couple of people say that they're going to be allowing people to use dogs to hunt turkey. And I've read some of the methods and why it works as far as the turkeys spread allows you to sit in the spot and then they come back into that area again to regroup. Why down south there's a lot of hunting seasons that allow dogs. Why hasn't the northern area or even Wisconsin opened up to that a little bit more? Is it a lot of it that has to do with just the irresponsibility of the hunters, or does it have also to do with you know, spread of disease or anything like that? You know, that maybe dogs may have or even the wildlife may have.
Well, Brad, I'm going to try and sort out your question there. I think the fundamental issue is, will dogs be legal for turkey hunting in Wisconsin? And there have been some experimental areas in the western, west central part of the state where dogs have been tried. But that's primarily fall hunting. And, you know, it's a matter of the ability to call turkeys and rely on the behavior of breeding toms in the spring to be the basis of spring turkey hunting, which is kind of the gold standard of turkey hunting. That doesn't apply in the fall because it's not the breeding season. Therefore, turkey hunting in the fall becomes a lot more catch-as-catch-can and a lot more like wandering through the woods looking for a grouse, in which case a dog might be helpful. There are some tactics like you described, breaking up a flock, for example, in the fall and then setting up and using certain calls to reunite, to take advantage of the fact that the broken-up flock, especially the young birds, have a strong desire to get back together with the rest of the family, and you can imitate the calls they use, and they'll come right back to the spot. Very effective technique in the fall, and one for which dogs are irrelevant. So there are ways to hunt turkeys in the fall without dogs. There are some people who have suggested that dogs might be, you know, they add a new dimension to the hunt. They may help find crippled birds or those kinds of things. But I don't think dog hunting for turkeys is going to be widespread. I think it's relegated to fall, and I'm not sure what the DNR's plans are for expanding those experimental opportunities to greater portions of the state. I just don't know. Maybe somebody can call in on that, or perhaps they haven't decided. I would guess that would go to the Spring Conservation Congress hearings, which are coming up on April 13th, before that opportunity was greatly expanded. So,
yeah, I couldn't imagine using them in the spring anyway. They wouldn't.
I think most dyed-in-the-wool turkey hunters who are really into the calling and so forth would, you know, for example, I have a couple of dogs and I love to hunt with my dogs, but I wouldn't want them anywhere near me when I was turkey hunting in the spring. It would defeat the whole experience.
Thank you.
Yep. Thanks, Brad, for calling. Appreciate it. Judy and Custer, we're on to you now. Hi, Judy.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Scott.
Hello.
Scott, I'd like to know something about the distribution and quantity of weasels in Wisconsin. I had the good fortune this winter to see one on my deck, and he was all white with the black tip. Mm-hmm. And in the 23 years we've lived here, this is the third sighting I've had, and I, you know, they're hard to see, but I'm just wondering, are there lots of them, and mm-hmm. where do they live?
All right.
Well, good question, Judy. First of all, the weasel family of mammals, the family Mustelidae, is a big group of mammals in Wisconsin, and there are many members. So technically, we won't talk about them this morning, but everything from mink, pine marten, otter, fisher, even badger, they're all weasels. But I think it's the smaller ones you're interested in, say below mink size. They're all kind of long and cylindrical. Mm-hmm. But the three that most people think of typically as weasels are the least weasel, which is the tiniest one. It's about the size of a good-sized Cuban cigar and has a very short tail and no black tip on the tail.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All three of them turn white in the winter. So we have the least weasel, mm-hmm. the short-tailed weasel, or otherwise known as the ermine, and then the long-tailed weasel. But members of the weasel family are sexually dimorphic, meaning the males and females are different size. Oh. Males can be twice as big as a female in some species. So a really big male short-tailed weasel and a really small female long-tailed weasel overlap. So it would be very difficult. In fact, my class is working on weasel identification in a lab exam this Friday, and we do not expect them to be able to separate the short-tailed from the long-tailed weasel for that reason. But anyway, those are the three. They all turn white in the winter. They're all kind of a chocolate brown in the summer with a beige or cream-colored belly. And the short-tail and long-tail have the black tail tip. The middle-sized one, the short tail, is the one known as an ermine. That's the one people would be familiar with from seeing the little white pelts with the black tail tips on royal gowns and on Native American headdresses and things like that. All three are reasonably common, pretty widely distributed. Collectively, they're found statewide, although there's a little difference in distribution in the three species. But they are very elusive. And, you know, about the only way I hear of people seeing them, three ways. Either one happens to visit a bird feeder looking for an easy meal and you see one as you did. Uh-huh. Or cats occasionally capture especially the least weasels and lug those into the house, and you might encounter one that way. Or if you're patiently sitting out in the woods just taking a break, or maybe sitting on a hunting stand or waiting to take a picture, and you hear something rustling around in the underbrush, that could very well be a weasel. And one of the tactics to improve your chances to see one under those circumstances are to squeak them up. Suck on the back of your hand like this.
Oh, yeah, like a mouse.
Give that kind of squeaking, sucking sound on your hand, and it does sound like a mouse or a baby rabbit in distress. And that's weasels are very curious, always looking for a free lunch, and that will usually pop them up out of the brush pile or the hollow log or whatever to take a look until they realize their mistake, and they're gone again. And that's about the size of it.
The one we had, one of them that we had seen that was not the white and black, in the wintertime, we saw one in our driveway, and it was dead. It had a puncture in it, but we kind of think a red-tailed hawk must have caught it and then dropped it.
Quite possible. And as you go up the line in size, the next one in size would be a mink, which looks just like what it is, a bigger weasel, although they do not change color and are generally a darker, richer brown, mahogany brown with a white blaze on their throat. In the northern part of the state, although they're very rare at this point and there's still some efforts to restore their population, next one up in size would be the kind of blonde-colored marten, which looks something like a mink, spends a fair bit of its time in trees, and then the rest of them are bigger than that. So That's the
story.
That's the primer on weasels.
Thanks a lot for calling, Judy. Appreciate it. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you have a wildlife question, something you've seen or heard about, or just a wildlife question in general, I hope you'll join us. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email at talk@wpr.org. And let's turn to Marilyn and South Range next. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi. Well, I'm one of those people that love to feed birds, summer, winter, and everything like that. And we have a split-entry house with an attached screen porch. And for years, what I did is I had a bird feeders at the top. So that's about 12, 15 feet up in the air. And would try to keep the bears away, which in South Range, we have a couple of them around.
Yeah.
And so anyhow, I put them on pulleys and would, you know, fill them when they were down on the ground and lift them up and had a cord that was hanging, and then there was an S-hook type thing. Well, one bear decided that he was going to go through the use our lattice work that we have on the bottom for decorative purposes to climb up to these things.
Mm-hmm.
So the next morning we had a hole about the size of a bear in the lattice work where he fell right through.
Oh, man.
Second of all, then later on, well, we repaired that and put something that they can't climb on or even hope to. But second of all, then I still had these S-hooks where I would put them up in the air and put them down. And later on, they discovered how to get the cords to come down. So therefore, the only way I could do it is to take out, I have a rickety old ladder that I use at that point and just store it nearby, and put another S-hook way at the top so that, so that they couldn't get to the cord even, because they would get the bird feeder down somehow or other.
Well, earlier we described the bears kind of like a giant squirrel, but I guess I'd say maybe the cross between a giant squirrel and a giant raccoon.
Right.
But I guess that's a very good point that you make, that we should remind, if Stacy or others are listening, while you're trying to defeat bears, don't position your feeders where there's, if your feeder's out there, take a look at the house and try and figure out what a bear's going to figure out. And if that means they're going to have to tear your deck apart or go through a screen porch or something to get at the feeder, they can and they will.
Yeah.
And therefore, don't risk, in order to keep the feeder up, don't risk a lot more damage or a lot more grief in dealing with the bears. So keep the feeder away from the house a bit if you can.
And they never figure out how to use that old ladder, though.
Oh, right. No, they never did. But we've put steel siding on the side of our house, so we can't really put the bird feeders on there. So I do take them in and put them out during the day, even if it's just a couple of hours if we're home.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a good idea.
Too.
If you're willing to do that, that's a good idea. Just put the feeder out when you can actually keep an eye on it, at least around my feeding station. The birds are checking it regularly, and if it's empty, for example, and I fill it, it's usually not but a few minutes before the birds are right there. So,
yeah. Thanks a lot.
Good idea.
Appreciate the call, Marilyn. Diane and Ashland, we're on to you now. Hi, Diane.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have a question about something my husband and I saw last spring camping. We're tent camping in kind of a remote site in the UP of Michigan.
Yeah.
About 3 o'clock in the morning, we could hear something coming through the woods, and it was like screaming and shrieking, and it kept coming right up around our tent until it was a kind of a moonlit night,
mm-hmm.
and it was two, whatever they were, and they were facing off against each other. They were low to the ground, kind of, and maybe as big as a raccoon. But kind of flatter, and would that have been a pipe? They just kind of circled each other, facing each other, and screaming at each other, and then we kind of got a flashlight to see if we could light them up, and that scared them. They were gone. But it was really bone-chilling sound.
I don't like the sounds of it, and I'm sitting here in the studio.
Yeah, I'm thinking about being in a tent.
It was like a nightmare thing coming through the woods. It really was scary to hear, and you could, it started at a distance, and you could just hear it. So it was two, whatever they were. Could that have been badgers? I've seen badgers, and it was a little smaller than what, and I've seen a badger once.
It could have been. They are flat to the ground and about raccoon size, so that's a possibility. But you're sure they weren't raccoons?
I'm positive.
Okay.
Yeah, they,
all right,
when
so.
They took off, they just like flew, and I've seen plenty of raccoons. They didn't have the body shape.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, then badger's certainly a possibility. And if you were looking at the back end of a departing badger, you wouldn't have seen that nice striped face to give them away.
No, you could just see dark, silhouetted, in the pine trees,
kind of see,
with the moonlight, and
could
just
you
circling
see
each other and screaming and hissing. And
could you see a tail?
Yeah, there was a tail. That's why I wondered if it could be a pine marten, because somebody told us it was probably martens.
Well, Martin, the possibility, but I think Fisher's a better
possibility.
Fisher would
be a better possibility.
Fisher's more raccoon size, and the tail would be more distinctive. A Martin's a fairly modest-sized animal, not much kind of giant squirrel size, more than raccoon size, and they're not rotund at all. They're fairly slender and long, more like a mink.
I'd bet on Fisher.
So I would say Fisher or Badger, but if they were dark and disappeared quickly, I would think Fisher.
All right. There you have it. Thank you for calling, Diane. Appreciate the call. Jeff in Janesville. On to you now. Hi, Jeff.
Morning, fellas. Hey, couple questions here on deer behavior, I guess. I live out in the country, but there's a fair amount of homes in the area, all 2-3-4 acre deals. So you kind of, all winter, you get to know the deer in the area.
Mm-hmm.
And all winter, there's been a very small yearling that... I I've never seen her with a doe. I'm assuming her mom didn't make it either through the hunting season or just through the winter. But she's never herded up with the other groups. It's not common that you have, you know, threes, fours, sixes at a time going through all does.
Mm-hmm.
But this little one, she's clearly at the bottom of the pecking order, but she's not even with the herd. I mean, if some of the other deer come into the yard, she walks out, she stays 100 yards away, she'll bed down, you know, 2 yards over from where they're at.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just assuming she's low on the totem pole and so low that she doesn't hang with them. But it seemed odd to me. I know there's always a hierarchy in a herd,
mm-hmm.
but I'm not used to seeing such a young, you know, yearling off by herself.
Okay, what do you think, Scott?
Well, I think you've probably summed it up pretty well with your supposition, Jeff, that this is an animal that was the rest of the family unit, and they tend to be in a hierarchical, matriarchal group, the way you describe, with the old doe kind of leading the pack and her generations of offspring around, and then last year's fawns. And this one may be, it could be an animal that dispersed into the area and simply left the home territory. It could be an animal where, again, the rest of its social unit met, you know, who knows what. I nearly took out a social group coming home last night at 10 o'clock, and I scared myself pretty well because all I saw was the butt of a deer that had already apparently passed in front of me, and I never saw the darn thing.
Oh,
so
man.
There are many things that might befall deer, considering the way the last two winters have been. And it may very well be, as you suggest, or speculate, that it's a deer that's on the outside of that social group and is just kind of hanging on the periphery. But there's no reason why it won't make it. We're entering into a nice period of weather here, and if it's gotten this far through the winters, it's able to take care of itself, and it should be fine.
I've seen her recently, and early in the season, I didn't think she'd make it. She obviously was a late spring yearling last year,
mm-hmm.
and being on her own, I didn't think she was going to make it. I wondered, too, if she was unhealthy, if the rest of the herd, you know, I don't know if they give off a smell or a sense or what. Do you know, might that be a cause?
I don't think so. I think generally, you know, with most animals, while an animal that might be injured or ill might separate itself, you know, voluntarily,
yeah.
Either because physically it can't keep up or whatever other reason. Generally speaking, all a debility might do is further accentuate the herd being able to dominate that animal at a feeder. Of course, in southern Wisconsin now, feeding is verboten, but if you watch deer around feeders in the northern part of the state, they have a pretty good line authority on who eats when, and if you're a low person or low deer on the totem pole, you don't eat at all until it's an opportunity when nobody else is around. But I don't think that they would necessarily be persecuting it or treating it as an outcast because of disease or disability.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling, Jeff. Appreciate it. We'll go to Jim in Winneconne next. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, I was home the other day, and I've got a 30-acre prairie behind my house, and I was watching a beautiful red fox slowly walk across it. Actually came pretty close to my home. My question is when is the breeding season for fox? Because it didn't look like it was after mice. It was just very slowly walking across.
Well, they're out meandering around. Everything will be out meandering around, excuse me, with the 50-degree weather we've got coming up the next few days. But the breeding season for fox, in terms of them being active and yipping and howling and chasing each other around, is probably over. They start very early in February. And, you know, that individual may have already been headed back to its mate or dealing with the den operations or something else, or just going from point A to point B. But a lot of the breeding activity for fox and coyotes and whatnot is already behind us.
Mm-hmm.
It was quite fun. We put on our snowshoes and followed the tracks the next day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's...
Well, did they lead you to anything that might shed some light on what it was up to?
No, there was a lot of fox tracks, though.
So there's probably, you know, I think there's a good chance there's probably a den site around there. And, you know, their gestation period is about the same as all members of the dog family at a couple of months. So if the breeding activities wound down, there's a couple months here before the litter is born that if you start keep following those tracks, as long as we've got snow, you might actually have an opportunity to observe activity around the den site later on.
Yeah.
Beautiful thing to watch, and thank you very much.
Sure. Yeah, thanks, Jim. Judy and Ryo, your turn. Hi, Judy.
Hi. Thanks a lot for the show. I love this show.
Thank you.
I wait for it every month. My question was partially answered by the last guy. I was wondering about the mating season of coyotes and how soon the pups are taken out of the den.
Well, as we said, for some of these animals, the breeding season has, in terms of mating activity and all that goes along with that, in terms of the behaviors, is winding down or over. Now there's a kind of a down period where the females are pregnant and the pups are developing internally, and then births are going to start to occur, around latter part of April, May, and so forth. With pups like these things, I'm trying to think of the weaning period, but I wouldn't expect to start, although you might see the pups starting to poke out of the den toward the latter part of May, early June. The pups really aren't going to be out and doing much until at least that period of time. Mm-hmm. So there's still a ways to go before they'd be out and about.
Okay.
Can I ask another question?
Sure.
Okay.
Will a coyote cross with a stray or a domestic dog? And the reason I'm wondering is because I have a tracking book that shows the size of a coyote paw,
mm-hmm.
and I keep seeing one that's really big, but it's got those pointed out toes just like the coyote
mm-hmm.
track, so I'm pretty sure that it is a coyote, but it's big. And I was wondering, if they cross with a dog, then do they have the coyote print like that?
Well, first of all, there's a great deal of range and overlap among the canid or dog family tracks. It's really an art to be separating among the various groups. And when you throw dogs and all the many domestic breeds and sizes and shapes in, it becomes a bit of a mess. If you were dealing just with fox, coyote, wolf, the measurements and so forth separate them pretty well. But there's also some differences within the species, in that a big male might be, the track might be a bit larger than what you'd expect for a female. But the short answer to your question is there are such things as coy dogs. There is some crossing that goes on, and in different parts of the country that's more or less of a problem than it might be in others. There are also wolf-dog hybrids. Now, having said that, the peculiar thing about the behavior of these animals is that the members of the dog family don't necessarily get along very well in the wild, and there's more concern amongst people of coyotes killing dogs, pets and hunting dogs, mm-hmm. and wolves doing the same thing, wolves killing coyotes killing fox and so forth, than necessarily breeding. But at some point in the system, either they meet an animal that's similar size, or I don't know what the attraction is, maybe they bring flowers, box of candy, I'm not sure. But instead of the aggressive behavior, mating can and does take place, and the result is hybrids that really confound the identification issue. And in fact, at a Wildlife Society meeting yesterday, we're just hearing that the DNR is preparing a package of regulations to increase the regulation on wolf-dog hybrids in terms of both if they happen to occur in the wild and as captive animals. So yes, Judy, it does happen, and it could very well confound your identification of the tracks.
And thank you very much for calling, Judy. We'll go to Joe in Oshkosh next. Hi, Joe.
Hi. Thanks for the program.
Sure.
It's my favorite. Anyways, I'm 56 years old. I've lived my entire life in Wisconsin. I've never heard of a seagull attacking anyone. That is till last summer. It was June 12th, we had this big flood in Oshkosh, and it was a week later. And there was still standing water where you'd never see water, like in this big grass field. And I was checking out these plovers or some kind of a bird. I couldn't really figure out what they were in these puddles. I'm standing about 50 yards from the Fox River, and all of a sudden a seagull comes down right for my head, takes a V-line right for me.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just took my baseball cap and ducked and swatted, and I thought, well, I better get out of here. And I started heading for the road away from the river. And it kept attacking, and I kept swatting, and I ran for 100 yards, and when I got to the road, I thought, this should be okay here. Sure enough, it happened again, and I was so tired, I couldn't run anymore.
Boy, where's the video? Where's the video camera when you need it?
Oh, really? Anyways, I felt like the movie The Birds, you know, that scene of the school children and all that. But anyways, I grabbed a stick with it pointed on the end, and I knew I had to. I couldn't run anymore. I just said, "Come on, you know," swore at them, and waved it around. They circled a couple times and left, and that was it. But my question is, why did this happen? And does it happen to other people? And are there any birds that have actually in Wisconsin that have actually, you know, hurt anybody? It didn't actually, you know, hit me.
Yeah.
You know. Well. Yeah. There are many birds in Wisconsin that will defend their nesting territories by attacking. You know, we call it attacking, but basically they swoop down, especially when you're facing away or walking away. They'll swoop down and can come very close to your head, and in some cases brush a hat or even hit you. Even the swallows in my yard will do that repeatedly and be a nuisance of themselves. Red-winged blackbirds will do it. Gulls will certainly do it if you're anywhere near a nesting colony. You need to keep your wits about you because there'll be lots of birds diving and attempting to drive you out the same way they would dive bomb a cat or other potential predator. And that's all they think you are, is just another predator around the nest site. Cooper's hawks are notorious for it. We get lots of calls on those in urban areas.
Golf courses.
There have been cases where birds will swoop down and actually, you know, nick somebody in the back of the head or on an ear, or if you're biking or something like that, and all of a sudden you don't have your wits about you, all of a sudden, whack, a bird whacks you in the back of the head, and you fall off the bike or swerve into traffic, yes, you could be badly hurt. And some of the raptors, the hawks and owls, If you're actually bothering the nest to the point that you're perhaps climbing a nest tree, whether inadvertently or intentionally, people have been badly hooked with the talons of an owl. That's not a
ouch.
Good. That's a big ouch. So sure, there are cases like that, Joe. Now whether the bird in question was, you know, had just had a bad experience around a nest site or what, I don't know, or maybe had been persecuted by a person. There are other birds that you would never think of as causing a problem for people, like a ruffed grouse, for example. And yet there's a bird where, and again, there was just a video circulating on the internet with a fellow who stopped on the side of the road for lunch. A grouse came out of the woods and started chasing him around and pecking at his shoes and flying up at him. And, you know, what's going on there? The vast majority of the grouse or gulls or blackbirds or whatever have no interest in you at all. But all of a sudden there's one that either because of where they are in the reproductive cycle or a hormonal imbalance, or maybe they're just having a bad day, but all of a sudden do something that you wouldn't expect. And I think what you witnessed was an unusual event, and you'll probably never experience it again. But the short answer is there are many birds that will
do it.
Attack, in a sense, a person in defense of family or property, as they view it.
And thanks very much for calling. Remember last summer there was a Cooper's hawk that had a nest along a golf course. And golfers would, you know, walk by and, you know, on the fairway, and the hawk would swoop down and try and take off their hat or come close to taking off their hat.
Adds a new dimension to the game.
It sure does. Thanks again. Appreciate the call, Joe. Jeanette in La Crosse, your turn now. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi. I have a question that's been kind of bothering me, and I was wondering if I can get some feedback on it. A few months ago, I live in La Crosse here, and they have Myrick Park Zoo, and we had two healthy bucks that lived there. They're pets, you know, and they ran around in the zoo. Well, they decided they're going to remodel this zoo and make it a nature center or whatever, and they decided they're going to put some elk or something in there, and they said, well, what happened is they secretly euthanized the two pet deer, and when people found out about it, they were really upset, and they said, well, they had to do it because they couldn't relocate them. And I was thinking, well, somebody had to move them in the first place to get them there. They relocated them at least once, right? So why would they just take two beautiful, healthy bucks that were pets and just put them down?
I can't tell you that, Jeanette. I would assume that that's a case where, again, a community that maybe is upset by this particular action going through whoever runs the zoo, going through your local city council people. This is really a social or biopolitical problem more than a wildlife or biological problem. I don't know where the deer came from in the first place, whether they were orphaned animals that had been in the zoo since birth, for example. There are some problems now that you may find get cited in that movement of deer from one facility to another or from a facility to the wild has been greatly curtailed because of problems with chronic wasting disease. And there are cases where captive deer in Wisconsin on deer farms and so forth have tested positive for that, and that has resulted in these regulations. And no one wants to jeopardize the huge and very important wild deer herd in Wisconsin any more than it already is by potentially introducing more disease into the herd. So just opening the pen and saying, hey, Joe and Charlie, go live happily ever after, that probably wasn't an option. But it seems like there might have been other options available. I simply don't know what the circumstances were. Mm-hmm. And I realize I can see where you would find it disappointing and somewhat perplexing, but I think you need to pursue an answer from the people who made that decision, and that's about all I can tell you.
Yeah. Thank you very much for calling. Wish we could be more help on that one, but get a hold of those officials and find out what's going on. Matt in Decorah, Iowa, it's on to you now. Hi, Matt.
Hi. I have a question about snapping turtles in our ponds.
Mm-hmm.
We have 3 really large ponds that we have stocked with bass and bluegills and catfish, but lately, it's been less and less of the smaller fish, and we see more and more turtles. And actually, last year, we had 2 turtles that were fighting on top of the water, and it looked like 2 ducks. And as we got closer, we seen them there, and I had enough time to go back to the house, get a gun, and shoot them, and they still were fighting, even when after I shot at them.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious to know, what can we do to curb the turtles? We've tried trapping. People that trap them come in and get a couple of them, but some of them are so small that they can't get them, and I don't want them to get big. Is there something that we can do to stop them?
A lot of folks who are managing aquaculture facilities or fish ponds or managing for ducks or whatever else are not happy about a high population of snapping turtles. A few painted turtles or some of the other turtles that are in there, hey, no big deal. And I don't think there's any reason to necessarily declare all-out war on all turtles. But in terms of the bigger snapping turtles, there are some very effective trap designs that are available. And if you're anywhere near any of the big river systems where you may be able to find out through a local sportsman's club or through a DNR office, you know, who's one of the best local turtle trappers around, you should be able to find somebody who come in there and remove, just because they could then have the turtles, remove quite a number of them for you. It's not that hard to catch them. You know, something as simple as a bleach bottle mm-hmm. with the cap on it and a stout piece of fishing line and a fish hook baited with some bacon or a fish head or something. And
we do that.
Yeah.
We've done that. And we've also used the one, or the trappers have come in, and I think they get so many and then they're tired of it. But we have 3 of them that are rather large. One of them, the pond, is we water ski in it, actually.
It's a good sized pond. Well,
yeah, and what I'm having a problem with is we're actually finding them walking to our ponds from on the outside of our area. We have enclosed in elk fence, and so we have elk and everything. But as we're checking the stream and everything, the bigger turtles are actually walking towards our ponds. I mean, we'll catch 1 or 2 a summer.
Yeah. Well, I mean, depending on what time of year, the snapping turtles are out wandering around looking for nest sites, and it's kind of hard to tell whether they're coming or going or have gone and are coming back. So it's not necessarily the fact that you're a magnet for all turtles in the area. They have no way to get the word out on that. But I think removing the large specimens, especially potentially nesting specimens, which would have a greater impact on the population, would help. Trapping would help. Anything you can do in that regard. If you, I'm just going to suggest something. Since you're a little frustrated than this, I'll suggest something that will give you a good laugh. Go to YouTube on the computer and type in Turtle Man. And there's about a 3 or 4 minute video on a fellow in Kentucky who calls himself the Turtle Man and travels around ridding ponds of snapping turtles. I'm not suggesting you could get him to come up and take care of your ponds, but I think you'd get a pretty good laugh out of how this fellow very effectively, with nothing but his hands and feet, removes snapping turtles from a shallow pond. Yours probably aren't conducive to that.
No.
But to the other listeners who might be interested in turtles, Turtle Man video has made quite a splash in the wildlife community. But again, I think if you're persistent in removing turtles you see that are out looking for nest sites, getting somebody in to trap, using your own trapping techniques, you should be able to stay on top of it. I mean, I'm not sure I would also tend to get a fisheries manager in there and, you know, do some fish surveys or have them check out the situation. I'd be sort of surprised to think that a decline in your fish stocks could be directly attributable to turtles only.
Yeah.
I'm concerned that there might be something else going on.
Yeah. Good
okay?
luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Our guest, I'm Larry Mueller, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You can join in with your question for Scott at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call or email at talk@wpr.org. Let's go to Victoria in Dodgeville. Victoria, hi.
Frequently walk our gravel road in west of Governor Dodge Park, about a couple miles west. And it's at night, 10 o'clock-ish, and all through the winter. And my question is one night recently I was out there, and my dog seemed to come to a standoff with a very large, large animal that was making a lot of noise in this frozen marsh area. And it was the only sound it was making was very, very low grunting. And I have heard all kinds of sounds out there of animals in distress or running from my dog or what have you. And I swear it was a wild pig, but everyone is telling me no. My question is, would a wild pig also squeal? Or what other large, and I say large because it was moving huge masses of grass as this was happening, what other animals would have a grunting sound as a distress or an aggressive sound?
But you never got a look at the animal.
I couldn't. It was dark. It was pitch black. And I was terrified. I was running.
Well, I can understand that. You know, I don't think you should necessarily dismiss the wild pig situation. I mean, that's a concern in southwestern Wisconsin. There's basically an open plea from the DNR urging hunters and anyone else who has the opportunity to get rid of those animals. Essentially during the deer season, shoot them on site, report them so they can be tested for various diseases. The USDA Wildlife Services people have been after them in many ways. So the pig possibility is certainly there. And that would be something. This was a while ago, quite a while ago?
About 2-3 weeks ago.
Well, you know, even with that length of time, it's still something that I think it'd be worth, since you're near Dodgeville, call the DNR office there and say, gee, I think I might have had an encounter with a wild pig, and give them the location. And that's, that may be information that's useful to them or not. But, yeah, that's a possibility. In terms of low grunting in the woods in that area, in terms of a large animal, there's nothing that makes
the
a
list
low,
is pretty short.
The list is pretty short, a white-tailed buck, although it's more often done during the rut, makes an incredibly low guttural grunting sound, and it's the basis for deer calls and so forth that are used.
And I've heard
more.
That.
No. Okay, and that didn't sound right.
No, this wasn't that. I've heard deer snorting and deer grunting and raccoons fighting, coyotes circling, all of it, because I hear it all at night. But
if it's big like a pig, it sounds like a pig.
Big like a pig, sounds like a pig, smells like a pig. But, you know, the other possibility is we, a group of friends and I, have hunted deer on a farm not too much east of Dodgeville for many years. And we had a case, this was a number of years ago now, but a domestic pig had gotten loose from a neighboring farm and made a heck of a commotion on the farm that we hunted on. And ultimately, during the summer, it had piglets, and there ended up to be 10 or 11 of the things. And holy cow, we heard and saw them all the time, and they were tearing up the landscape and so forth. So it's possible that it may have been one of these so-called wild pigs that we're hearing about and we'd like removed, but it's also possible in an agricultural area like that that it was it was just a pig that got out.
Yeah.
So.
Yep. Thank you for calling, Victoria. Appreciate your call very much. Scott, you know, this time of year, a lot of people are out or have been out in the landscape searching for sheds.
Yes. As a matter of fact, I was surprised to hear, you know, I know lots of people who spend some nice winter afternoons or spring afternoons after the bucks have shed their antlers out roaming around looking for the antlers of that buck that got away during the fall or just looking for them in general. And as it turns out, it's a bigger deal than I thought. In fact, the North American Shed Hunters Club, which publishes the Shed Antler Records book, is holding their annual expo coming up at the end of this month, the 27th to the 29th in Wisconsin Dells. And it's a big deal. People spend a lot of time out looking for sheds, and they're actually measured and evaluated, and there's a record book for the shed antler, there is for trophy bucks. And, of course, antlers have become very popular in all sorts of home decorations, from lamps and cribbage boards with holes drilled in them and all sorts of things. So the bottom line is, now that the weather's getting better, in any rural area where there's a good concentration of deer, going out and looking for shed antlers is kind of a fun way to spend an afternoon.
Yep.
And there have been some articles in the papers and other outlets over the last few weeks in terms of offering tips on, you know, look for the ridgetop bedding areas or look for thick brush where they're going from point A to point B and the antlers
along
are knocked
fence
off
lines sometime.
Along fence lines, places like that. So, you know, hey, it's something else to do at a time of year when maybe there's not that much to do outside.
Mary in Madison, on to you. Hi, Mary.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about wolves. My husband and I go up to the Boulder Junction area a couple times, 3-4 times every year, and we walk our dog in the woods. And should we be concerned about wolves or even just letting him out to do his business at 10 o'clock at night by himself?
Well, I'd like to say no, but I guess I'll say a qualified yes in terms of concern. First of all, there have been a substantial number of dogs killed by Wisconsin's wolves that currently number around 550. So, yes, there have been dogs killed. Most of the dogs killed have been trailing hounds, you know, bear hounds, things like that, that are running across large areas of the landscape rather than bird dogs and pets that are generally under somebody's fairly close control. But so while I'd say the risk is relatively low, it's not zero. I have a cabin in northeastern Price County, and, you know, it's something that I think about a bit as I'm out wandering around with the two Labrador retrievers who wouldn't know a wolf from a pork chop, essentially, and would probably more likely attempt to approach it than flee. So it's a bit of a concern, but You can either, through the DNR website, there's lots of useful information on wolves, living with wolves, dealing with dogs around wolves on the DNR website. And you can also find out where they usually post information or make information available on packs of wolves that are notorious in terms of their interaction, that pose the greatest risk or threat to dogs. And there are a few packs that have been implicated in more dog kills than others. I don't know of any offhand in the Boulder Junction area, but again, you can get that information if you're nervous about it. Check with the DNR office. I'd start with the Park Falls Service Center. While the service centers are still open, I think many are going to fall victim to the recent budget cuts, and get what information you can. And realistically, it's a small risk. It's part of living in the North Woods, and it is, you can't say it's zero risk.
Thanks for calling. Let's go to Ilse, who is in Western Maine, and I think listening online. Ilse, hi.
How do you do? I am listening online, and what a wonderful advance in technology that I can do this all the way from Maine.
Thanks for calling.
Yes, I was. I want to revisit the conversation that you had earlier with respect to birds defending nesting territory.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if either of you have heard of how tenacious goshawks can be with defending their nesting territory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, in most Most raptors are especially tenacious, and they also have the equipment to be tenacious and are generally sizable. So, you know, actually, if there were one bird I would attempt to avoid at all costs around their nest, it wouldn't be a raptor or anything else. It would be a swan. I've gotten close to swan nests, and I got close to a swan nest actually fairly close to you in Maine on a pond in New Hampshire when I was going to school there. And holy mackerel, when those swans came across the water at the canoe and they were about 3 feet over us while they were still in the water, that made me very fidgety. So,
now, sorry to interrupt, but were those the introduced mute swans, or
yes,
were they any of the native swans?
No, in this case, these were introduced mute swans on essentially a mill pond in the in the university community there.
Yeah. The goshawk question was because I know a third-hand story, but from a very reputable source, of a person whose jugular was actually severed by the talons of a defending goshawk.
Wow.
Whoa.
Well, that obviously is an extreme case, but
I guess,
you know,
it can happen.
Those kinds of things can happen.
And Elsie, we need to take a break, so thank you very much for calling. Scott Craven, our guest here on the Ideas Network. Talking the wonderful world of wildlife today with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller. Glad to have you listening in. Scott, we have a kind of a man-bites-dog story, but it relates to deer and wolves. And I thought, yeah, you got to tell that story.
Well, this came out early last week, I think, and I had the actual email, and I searched my office this morning, couldn't find it. But the gist of the story, and this came down from northern Wisconsin, I think it was Ashland County, and the circumstance was a fellow who's credited with being a very reliable observer and good outdoorsman and so forth, but a logger who was operating a piece of logging equipment on a logging cut. And as is often the case, a deer realized that a logging operation is kind of a smorgasbord and a lunch buffet. So it was nothing unusual, but there were a lot of deer around the logging site while he was operating this piece of equipment. But strangely, there were quite a few deer very close to the piece of equipment, to the point that he had to be careful he wasn't going to knock some of them over or run over them. But for whatever reason, they were staying very close to the equipment. And I think we were talking, you know, a dozen or 15 animals or more. So that was a little odd in itself. But then as he looked out into the logging cut, or a few minutes later, whatever, here came two wolves, strolled out into the cut. And so that's why the deer are staying close to me. The wolves are on the hunt. But anyway, very shortly thereafter of the wolves being sighted, apparently six or eight deer from the group broke off from the group, and that consisted of what appeared to be, to him, mostly adult does and at least a couple of bucks that had shed their antlers. And these six or eight deer rushed the wolves and essentially surrounded the wolves and administered, in his words, quite a substantial beating, kicking kind of backwards like a mule and flailing with their hooves the way you see them wailing on each other around a food pile. But they apparently cornered the wolves and gave them a pretty good beating, to the point that eventually the wolves, to audible whimpering and whining that he could hear, and with one of them limping substantially, limped off into the distance, and the deer broke off the encounter, came back to the rest of the group. So apparently, and this came with some interpretation from the wolf biologist, that there were cases of this reported in the literature from other states. So it had been known to happen, and apparently even at some point where the deer have killed a wolf, although we don't have any such records from Wisconsin. But here's a case where the tables were turned, and we think of wolves as a predator that can pretty much do what they want. In this case, didn't work out that way.
Deer management goals, before we go back to the phones here, that's another issue that's been a hot-button issue, Scott.
It's been a very hot button, very much a hot button issue since the deer season, when in some parts of the state the deer harvest was down substantially, and that wasn't really predicted. And there's still a fair bit of anxiety amongst hunters on what's going on with the deer herd and what does the future look like. Well, every 3 or 4 years, the deer management units in the state are given a thorough review in terms of what's the unit population goal, what's the status of the population in the units. There are about 130 of these units scattered around the state, but they're kind of accumulated into groups, and then these reviews are held, and they're coming up here starting on March 10th and running through the 25th. So the issue here is for hunters who are concerned, want to have some input, just want to find out what's going on, find out where the unit you hunt in is being reviewed, what night it is, and go to the meeting. This is a chance to find out what's happening. And you can go to the DNR website. There are quite a few of these around the state. Down in the lower right-hand corner of the main webpage, the homepage, where I found it this morning under current events or issues in the right-hand corner, you can click on that, and that will lead you to where all these meetings are being held and when. Good way to get some input and some feedback.
Let's go to Ted in Chisago, Minnesota next. Ted, hello.
Yes, I have a question about albino deer. I had an opportunity to see an adult albino deer in Wisconsin and was just wondering how many there are or if there's any indication of how many deer there are in Wisconsin like that.
Well, they certainly do occur, and the a full true albino is given legal protection in Wisconsin, not protected in some states, but protected in others, including Wisconsin. A partial albino or piebald deer that's kind of blotchy, looks more like a Holstein, I believe is not protected. In fact, there have been some pictures circulating on the internet of a particularly nice piebald or partial albino buck that was taken this past season. So they do occur. There tend to be little pockets of them that are known. I think there's a pocket of albino deer, for example, up around the Boulder Junction area in northern Wisconsin. And one of our local, well-known local photographers and writers, a fellow by the name of Richter, published a very nice photo-based book on albino deer just a couple years ago, if you're interested in trying to track that down. So, yes, they occur, but they're a curiosity. I guess I've thinking about my own history in the state of 30-some years, and yeah. Larry's, I mean, I've seen a lot of deer, but have never seen an albino, and I hunt with a lot of people around the state who have not seen one either, so the opportunity to see one is a rare treat, so if you had that opportunity, congratulations.
Thanks, Deb, for calling. Appreciate it. Jim in Watertown, your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hi, how are you guys doing today?
Good.
Great.
I got a question on it. Actually, at your screener, I had two parts to this question. But the first part is I live on a little small 30-acre bass lake in northern Wisconsin, in O'Connell County, north of Mountain. And my question in regards to is otters. The last couple of years, we've had a set of otters on a lake. And I've heard that once an otter sets into a lake, it actually can destroy a population of fish on a small lake. The lake is fed by a branch of the O'Connell River. There's always something going into the lake. It's noted for bass and smallmouth and largemouth bass, but we also have perch and everything else in there.
Mm-hmm.
But then my question is, once you have an adult pair there, then you have juveniles, do they stay? What can we do to remove them from an area? Because it's such a vast area. And they maybe came down the river and landed in this lake and decided they'll stay here. Can they destroy a population in a small lake?
Well, you know, 30 acres is a small lake, but it's not a, you know, it's not a pond, basically. The concern with otters is usually more in smaller ponds, trout hatcheries, places like that, where they can get in and really do a substantial amount of damage. They can eat a lot of fish. And you can have a family group in there, although usually they don't. The fact that it's an abundant food source doesn't mean there's going to be a huge concentration of otters there.
Mm-hmm.
They certainly are. They are trapped, closely regulated, but trapped. And I would, if you're concerned about this for the future, I would check with your local. I'm going to tell you the best thing to do is check with your local DNR office anyway to see what you can possibly do. Is this a private lake or public?
No, it's in the Nicolet area.
Okay,
it's actually. I did contact a person in regards of the lake is actually going down in water because of the drought we've had in northeast Wisconsin over the last couple of years.
Right.
And my concern was the lake was actually getting smaller in regards to maybe the drought, but they have had some beaver problems there too. And they dammed it up, and then they have people destroy the dams, and then the water goes it dissipates.
Well,
but I've had the DNR warden look at the lake, and I haven't heard back from them guys on that. It's a separate issue.
Well, it's a separate issue, but it is a big-time issue in northern Wisconsin, which is in a fourth year of drought. And, in fact, we were hearing a talk on that on campus yesterday, and, boy, there are some lakes up there that are almost on the verge of gone. So we need some good spring rains, but the long-term prediction by climate change models and so forth is that it could be in for a long stretch where water levels are pretty low. But as far as the otters are concerned, ask the DNR folks what opportunities you have and how you might contact folks who have otter permits and might be interested in trapping in the area. And then also talk to the USDA Wildlife Services folks in Rhinelander. Call that office and ask them the same questions. And I think they'll be able to help you out in terms of hooking up with people that might be able to remove one or more otters and keep a lid on the situation. But, you know, with a productive bass and panfish fishery, there's likely a pretty good stock of fish in there. And I don't think it's any immediate risk to being wiped out. And some people would say, hey, the otters are pretty neat to have around, too. But I think you can at least keep a lid on the situation.
And thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And you mentioned the climate change business, and the society meeting yesterday really had some kind of discouraging news relating to that.
Well, I'd call it was discouraging, but it was more scary listening to. And I work on a couple of committees that are investigating this, but some of the potential predictions, and that's really all they are, is predictions at this point of what the various scenarios are with the likely increases in temperature, changes in precipitation, and the likelihood of more extremes in terms of storms and things like that. Those are some of the things that we hear about. But when you started to hear what the projections are for just a fairly small temperature increase, a modest temperature increase, the way the modeling goes, of the impacts on cold water fisheries, on trout populations, for example, of what the impacts of some of these things could be on animal behavior, bird movements, all sorts of different implications, as well as for the habitat itself and some of these precipitation regimes that are affecting northern lakes already. It was some pretty scary stuff. I mean, we have to hope that we can do something to at least mitigate or adapt to the potential changes that are coming. But turning it around, it seems to be a train that's already left the station. And we're going to have to deal with it now over generations to come. But it was pretty scary, Larry.
Joe in Dodge County, we'll go to you next. Hi, Joseph.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I have a little question. We've got like 550 wolves in Wisconsin. Is that correct?
Well, that is the population estimate, 550 plus or minus a few.
Okay. Now, one of them takes a calf or something. The DNR will do something about that, won't they?
Yes, they will, but the wolf situation is ping-pong ball-like in that we've been bouncing back and forth between these animals being considered an endangered species from the federal standpoint to being delisted to being relisted again. And the ability to delist them again was bogged down in the recent transition in the federal government, but hopefully we'll be on track again here shortly.
Okay.
What we
now
need.
My question actually was about eagles.
Okay.
We've got over 1,200 nesting pairs in Wisconsin.
Yep.
If they start doing farm animals, we can't do a thing about it, can we?
Well, exactly. What do you mean by doing something about it? I think there's some assistance potentially. I'm just trying to think.
So
of
what are
they
covered? Eagles are going to take what? What they might take chickens, let's say.
How about they take good sized ducks?
Perhaps.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now that's a real pain to some people.
It could be, and if what you're getting at, well, we can't do anything in the sense of, you know, rushing out there and blasting the eagle, that's really no different than the whole suite of raptors in terms of hawks and owls that are potential poultry problems, real poultry problems, and have been for many years. So what you have to fall back to in terms of preventing those kinds of depredations is the management of that poultry stock in terms of penning or, you know, how you treat your stock. But the fact that an eagle might take an occasional bird or something else is no different than what we've been living with for many years with many other types of raptors.
Yeah.
Well, actually it is. It really is, because you can't discourage them. I mean, they'll come right in front of you and grab a duck.
Yeah.
It's that bad. And, you know, the coyotes aren't that bad. There's just nothing that bad.
Well, what do you do in a situation like this? You probably, the only recourse you might have, and I don't even, I'm not sure if this is even possible, but I guess I would go to the DNR office and check with them and ask them about what might be done. I don't think there's much that can be done, though, Scott.
No, I don't think there is. And again, you come back to having to, if this is an issue where you are and you just have the eagles are so bold that the scare tactics that might deal with other raptors or whatnot are not working, then you have little choice but to manage that duck flock, however big it might be, a little differently and literally keep them penned or undercover. But having the ducks run around the yard, or I don't know what the management situation is in this case, that's a lunch sign to a whole host of different predators that are more or less easy to deal with or difficult to deal with. And if it gets to the point where that's no longer possible, then having the ducks running free in the yard is no longer possible.
Yeah.
So
there you have it. Thanks, Joe. Rosemary in Appleton, your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Thank you, gentlemen. I'm also concerned about wolves. I know that I've never heard of a wolf attacking a human being. Have you ever?
Yes. Well, it got a lot of play in Sports Illustrated magazine, of all places, with an article that we had talked about on past programs, not very long in the past. But it was a case in northern Canada, so it's not like it was in our backyard here in Wisconsin. But it is an extraordinary circumstance. In fact, it's still open to some debate as to how or why it actually happened. But anyway, go ahead.
I'm concerned about an elderly gentleman in his 80s who lives north of Merrill, and he knows he has wolves in his backyard. And he's afraid to walk to his workshop. You know, he's infirm and probably not walking that well. And I'm afraid that maybe the wolves will see him as bait. So he's afraid to go out there.
Well, I hate to see someone, modify or change their lifestyle for that particular fear. It's something that has not been documented, is an incredibly remote possibility. But, you know, before I stopped walking what's likely a fairly short distance to my shop, I would explore what I might carry with me or have in my pocket in terms of a pepper spray canister, which is a common thing used in areas where bears are perceived as a threat, or some type of noisemaker or other device. I'm reluctant for an elderly person who is a bit infirm, I'm reluctant to mention a firearm, because that might create its own set of problems. But certainly there are things that could be done for this gentleman or by this gentleman to improve his sense of security and allow him to at least use his shop.
Yeah.
If I don't know what the distance is, but whether...
And of course, when you're going through the snow, you're not walking that easily either.
Yeah.
Yes, that's true. But, I mean, what kind of a distance are we talking about here that he has to traverse?
How far does he have to go?
I don't know. I would say at least 500 feet, maybe.
Oh, it's quite a ways. Well, even so, the kinds of tools or techniques that I mentioned would perhaps provide him with security. And I'm always reluctant in these circumstances to say, well, there's really no risk here, because you just never say never. We learned that a long time ago, and I think it's in terms of walking 500 feet across snow and ice for an elderly gentleman, the risk of being on the snow and ice is a whole lot more serious than the risk of being taken by a wolf that might be going through the area or a limb being knocked down in a windstorm. That's how remote this possibility is. But if it's just a matter of psychological issue or peace of mind, then again, the pepper spray or some type of scare device or something that he might wear or carry or just have in his pocket may be enough to put him at ease, enough to make that trip to the shop.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. And Richard in Bayfield County, your turn. Hi, Richard.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I got a question about snapping turtles. We go swimming a lot up in a national forest lake up in Bayfield County, and it's only about a 7-acre lake. And we see a lot of snapping turtles, but we see one that's got to be over 2 feet long. And I wondered if you've ever heard of anybody, swimmers, ever being attacked by a snapper or a dog or anything like that?
Not in the water.
Okay.
Now, outside the water, when these guys are off wandering around in the late spring, early summer looking for nest site, they are very aggressive and will readily bite. But in the book entitled Natural History of Reptiles and Amphibians of Wisconsin by a fellow named Vogt, he actually speaks to this and talks about the fact that, for people dangling their feet out of a canoe or sitting on the dock, the notion that a big old turtle is going to come up off the bottom and remove a digit, it just doesn't happen. And if you want to see how remote this might be, I don't know if you were listening earlier, but I mentioned a short video clip that's on YouTube called The Turtle Man.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll see how this guy actually catches turtles, big snapping, big, ugly, mean snapping turtles with his bare hands and feet. I think if you watch that video with your family for a couple minutes, you're not going to be too concerned about swimming in that pond anymore.
Okay? I've often wondered, he looks prehistoric, he's so huge, I've often thought about it. I thought,
they're big, and I had one about that size latch onto my index finger when I was a kid, and it was a most unpleasant experience. I remember it very, very well. So I wouldn't want anybody else to go through it, but in the water, it's a remote possibility.
Thanks for calling. Scott, there was one other point I know you wanted to bring up.
Oh, the bobcat.
The bobcat, and we should mention that.
I'm not sure how much publicity this received, but it speaks to the mobility of some of these animals. People are often curious about, I think I saw this here or that there. And some of the larger species, the coyotes and the wolves and the bobcats and fishers, things like that, can cover a lot of ground. In this case, this was yet another roadkill. A bobcat hit by a car, found in the ditch up near Portage in Columbia County, I think a week ago last Sunday. The bobcat was dead. It was clearly a bobcat, no question about that. Where'd it come from? In one ear, it had a bright yellow tag that said Iowa DNR, and in the other ear, it had a bright yellow tag that had a series of dollar signs. So it was a reward tag situation, meaning that if somebody found the dead bobcat, the Iowa DNR was hoping that it would get reported, and there was a reward for doing so. Anyway, it ended up in the hands of our DNR folks, and it turned out the animal had been tagged in northeastern Iowa, which isn't, compared to some of these movements, all that far.
It may have
been a transient or Wisconsin bobcat in the first place that got marked in Iowa and was just headed home. I don't know. But in any event, it was a case where an animal had made a significant movement, and I think they're actually doing some DNA tests now to see if its genetic stock is related to northern Wisconsin cats.
Well, it could be a few hundred miles anyway.
It's a fair trek for any animal.
Reggie, you've got a quick question or comment.
Yes, sir. I heard the fellow talking about some ducks being taken by predators.
Yes.
Birds, I guess. Anyway, in Acres USA magazine, there's an advertisement for a product called Night Guard, NiteGaurd,
mm-hmm.
and the G's capitalized. But anyway, it's maybe it's like a flashing red LED, and then the animals interpret that as being a predator that's watching them.
Hmm.
The ones on the ground, maybe a wolf or a deer or a fox or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they had their ads in several months ago, maybe more than a year ago, for the birds that are flying in, they put four of them up on a post at a certain height.
Mm-hmm. And they keep them out. Oh. Well, Night Guard.
It probably great for owls and some other things, but, eagles are diurnal or daytime hunters, and, maybe this isn't the answer. Maybe it is, but...
And with that, we're out of time. Thanks, Reggie, for calling and hanging on there. And Scott, thank you. We'll see you again the first Wednesday of April.
Wow, April. I like talking about April already. That sounds
too.
Good.
Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Net.